Why do we feel guilty for feeling bad? There's something deeply wrong with a culture that promises perpetual happiness while pathologizing every uncomfortable emotion. We've built entire industries around avoiding pain. Self-help books that promise 5 easy steps, pharmaceuticals that smooth every rough edge, Instagram feeds curated to project endless joy. Yet here's the uncomfortable truth. Meaning doesn't emerge from mountaintops of bliss, but from the swampy, difficult territories we desperately try to avoid. The distinction between happiness and meaning isn't semantic. It's the difference between numbing ourselves and truly living. Those dark emotional states we medicate, distract from, and deny, they're not obstacles to growth. They're the very soil where it happens. We've inherited centuries of philosophical hand-wringing about the gap between what we want and what we get. But what if that gap isn't a design flaw? What if our suffering isn't something to fix, but something to move through? Jung saw neurosis not as illness, but as the suffering of a soul which has not discovered its meaning, symptoms pointing toward what needs healing. Most of us spend enormous energy fleeing from ourselves. We fill every moment with noise, distraction, busyness. We structure our lives to avoid solitude because silence forces us to confront uncomfortable questions. Who am I beneath my roles? What do I truly want? What have I been avoiding? The unconscious operates autonomously, beyond our control, surging up in dreams, slips of tongue, inexplicable moods. Our conscious ego frantically tries to maintain order, dusting the parlor while the basement floods. Real psychological work isn't about solving problems, but dialoguing with deeper forces, what Jung called the self. This requires moral courage, the strength to sit with discomfort, to ask what our symptoms reveal, to resist quick fixes. The swamplands aren't detours from life. They're where consciousness expands and we discover who we might become. Some guilt defies resolution. A woman who, during the Holocaust, led 2 children to the gas chamber to save herself, later discovered that photograph in a history book. She traveled seeking someone to hear her confession, knowing absolution was impossible. Her story reveals guilt's complexity. Terrible choices made under impossible circumstances whose consequences we must still carry. True maturity requires the 3 R's: recognition, recompense, and release. We acknowledge harm, make amends where possible, and eventually let go. But existential guilt, the unavoidable kind that comes with being human, persists. We survive by consuming other life. We compete for jobs. We make well-intentioned choices that produce unintended harm. Sometimes growth itself requires transgression, children leaving home, people breaking commitments that no longer serve their development. The question isn't whether we'll experience guilt, but whether we'll let it bind us to the past or use it to expand our consciousness. We begin life separated from the womb and end with the ultimate loss. Between these bookends, we lose security, innocence, loved ones, vitality, dreams. Every culture tells stories of Eden lost, expressing our longing for a connectedness we can never quite recover. Devin's story illuminates this. At 38, this architect had perfectly followed his alcoholic father's script. Same profession, living nearby, caretaking everyone. After his wife died of cancer, he felt psychically numb. His depression wasn't just grief for her, but for himself, the authentic life he'd never claimed. A breakthrough dream featuring Elvis Presley revealed how trapped he'd been in prescribed roles while his true self withered. Betrayal may be loss's most bitter form. It strips away innocence and trust, forcing us to see complexity where we once saw simplicity. The hardest part? Recognizing our own unconscious participation, the collusive ballet we unknowingly danced. Through suffering these experiences, we're pulled down and possibly through to a larger worldview. The message is stark. We cannot hold on to anything or take anyone for granted. What remains constant is the summons to keep growing. Pascal wrote that the silence of these infinite spaces frightens me, capturing our fundamental aloneness. Doubt, though uncomfortable, is essential for growth. The German word Zweifel means Zwonis, the split we feel when certainty crumbles. Without doubt, we remain trapped in childhood certainties. Life begins with traumatic separation from the womb, and we spend years seeking that lost connection. Even in intimate partnerships, as Rilke noted, loneliness goes on then with the rivers. By midlife, we must relinquish two fantasies: that we're exempt from the human condition and that someone will rescue us. The paradox: only by embracing our essential aloneness can we develop authentic selfhood and genuine connection. Rilke suggested that each should stand guard over the solitude of the other, not cold detachment, but profound respect, recognizing that each person must face their own journey, their own darkness, their own becoming. Churchill called it a black beast, Kafka a secret raven. Depression visits us all. Yet our culture pathologizes natural mood fluctuations rather than accepting them as normal counterpoints to joy. Depression takes multiple forms: reactive, following loss, endogenous, biological, and intrapsychic, when life energy is pressed down by internal conflict. Many function with walking depression, managing daily life while carrying a heavy soul. The task is separating past wounds from present identity. I am not what happened to me. I am what I choose to become. Depression at midlife often signals collision between false self and true self, presenting a terrible choice: anxiety or depression. Moving forward brings anxiety. Staying static brings depression. We must choose anxiety, for it offers potential growth while depression defeats life. Sometimes depression serves as therapeutic regression, calling us to recover split-off parts of ourselves. Medieval monks called this spiritual torpor acedia, the refusal to acquiesce in one's own being. The task is moving from victim to hero, wresting dignity from circumstance through struggle. This isn't about positive thinking. It's about facing what depression reveals about the gap between who we've become and who we're meant to be. By midlife, introspective people realize they're the only constant in their struggles. Obsessions are ideas that invade consciousness with enough power to supplant will. All addictions are anxiety management techniques. When psychic material triggers distress, our defenses activate through repetitive behaviors that temporarily reduce anxiety. But effects don't last, forcing the cycle to repeat, bringing guilt and shame each time. We're enslaved by unassimilated ideas anchored in our past. Our task is burrowing into the obsession to find the primal wound buried deeply. Anger's etymology means to constrict. When our natural spontaneity is constricted, anger results from overwhelming boundaries, environmental insufficiency, or our own complicity and self-wounding. When transformed by consciousness, anger becomes vital energy for healing. The common thread beneath all these states is anxiety, existential awareness of how precarious human existence truly is. The only way out is facing what the neurosis defends against. We cannot outrun ourselves or distract our way to freedom. The prison door opens only when we turn and face what we've been fleeing. Swampland states are unavoidable. They will pull us in repeatedly. We carry our hell with us, reconstituting it through repetition. Only after sufficient suffering can we acknowledge this paradox. We've become our own enemy. This recognition marks the beginning of consciousness. Each swampland state contains an implicit challenge to discover its meaning and the change it demands. Every neurosis is an offended god, some violated principle we must reclaim. Life isn't a problem to be solved, but an experiment to be lived. We cannot avoid the swamplands of the soul, but we may come to value them for what they bring: deeper meaning, enlarged consciousness, a further union with ourselves. The sweetness that comes to those who endure is real, not despite the suffering, but because of it. We don't transcend our wounds so much as integrate them. Your task isn't to be happy, but to be whole, and wholeness includes everything, even the parts you'd rather leave behind.